While we were away last week, a great many things happened between Yosef and the brothers, and they've come down to Mitzrayim. Yosef has risen to greatness, and the brothers really, from the first meeting, are completely disorientated. They have no idea why they're being accused of what it is, and misunderstanding begets misunderstanding. The money's given back, and it's a very difficult situation, and it culminates in the end of Miketz, where the Gavia, Yosef's Gavia, is found in the sack of Binyamin. And the final pasuk of Miketz is Yosef telling everyone that they can go home, and Binyamin will stay with him. And Yehuda steps forward in the beginning of Vayigash for a last attempt to bid for Binyamin, really. And Vayigash Elav Yehuda, so Yehuda approaches Yosef, Ayomer bi Aduni, please, Yedaberna Abdecha Dava Bazne Aduni, may I speak words, I hope they will enter your ears, I hope they'll reach you, connect with you, you connect with them. Vayicha Abcha Bavdecha, do not be angry at me, Ki Kamocha Kefara, you're like Far. And he begins recounting the episode. Aduni Sha'al Esav Adav Lemor. You asked us, Hayesh lechem avoach, you asked you have a father or brother, and we told you, Yehuda proceeds to unfold the story, we told you that we have a father and a brother, you said to bring the brother down, etc., and so forth. What's very interesting is, in Yehuda's, shall we say, recap of the story, there are certain things that we would expect to be there that are missing. And so there are other things that we would not expect to be there, which are present, and we would not expect to be there because they didn't happen. And by that we mean, as we quoted Pasuk Yud Tes, Aduni Sha'al Esav Adav Lemor, you asked, do you have a father or a brother? That's actually not true. That's something that the brothers told him, and for whatever reason, but it isn't something that Yosef asked. Why would Yehuda put a question in Yosef's mouth, or in this Egyptian leader's mouth, that he never said? Well, what does he mean to do by that? I mean, that's not helping anyone. That's not recounting what happened. On the other hand, much of the misunderstanding is not mentioned at all, as if to say, to establish that they're innocent. We brought money, and then accidentally the money came back. Well, we returned it, and none of that's mentioned, but that's really something that would vindicate them. And therefore, the Alshi HaKadosh explains that Yehuda's goal here is something else. As if to say there's been a bit of a realization, and very tentatively Yehuda puts to Yosef that what's really been happening, although he can't explain it, what's really been happening is something quite different than the way the brothers originally understood. As if to say, the brothers, the first thing Yosef says to them, or very quickly, rapidly, he accuses them of being spies. Without basis, as far as they are concerned. In order to establish their credentials, in order to establish their innocence, they begin to talk about themselves. And they say their family, as if to demonstrate that they mean no harm, we have an elderly father, our brothers at home, etc. And what Yehuda begins to realize is that given the fixation that this leader seems to have with Binyamin from the time that he's mentioned, he seems to be the exclusive focus. He says, Shimon's not going to go home until he comes down, and now he comes down, and somehow he's the one that ended up with the cup. And really what Yehuda is thinking is that perhaps from the outset, all you wanted to know from us was about this brother. I don't know why, but you spoke to us in a way, you never asked us frontally, do we have a brother? But the way that you spoke to us meant that we had almost no choice but to tell you. And it seems that that's what you were looking for in the first place. What's interesting is, just to pause for a moment, Yosef's claim that they are spies, I mean, where does that come from? But there are Midrashim and there are a number of interpretations, but in terms of the words themselves, it's interesting to consider. After all, if you look at the Psukim, he asks them, where are they from? They said they're from Canaan, and he says, you're spies. I mean, where, that seems to come out of the blue. Yosef needs to have some type of credibility, some type of hook, something. Did they do anything suspicious? All they've done is they said, come from Canaan. That's not so suspicious. It's a neighbor of Mitzrayim. But what's interesting about Yosef's opening question to them, by Yomer Alehem, may Ayin Basem. May Ayin Basem, translated literally, means, where are you coming from? Now, what's interesting about that expression is that certainly if we compare it with another person in the Chumash who has already asked people where they're from, and that's Yosef in the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, when he goes to the well in Haran, he sees the shepherds there, he says to them, Achai, may Ayin Atem, where are you from? That's a fine point here, and it's specifically a fine point. But Yaakov asked those shepherds, may Ayin Atem, and Yosef asked the brothers, may Ayin Basem. What's the difference between may Ayin Atem and may Ayin Basem? Well, may Ayin Atem can only mean one thing, where are you from? May Ayin Basem could mean that. It has a certain, in a sense, deniability. It could mean that, may Ayin Basem, where are you coming from? But because it doesn't say where are you from, but where are you coming from, it could also seem to have the indication, or the connotation of what brings you here. May Ayin Basem, where are you coming from, right? What's your business here? And therefore, the brothers, in a sense, in their endeavor to make a good impression and not perhaps be answer the question fully, so they responded to the full meaning of the question. May Ayin Basem, where are you coming from, means what are you doing here? So they said where they're from and what they're doing here. May Eretz Canaan Lishbor Ochel, we've come from Canaan to buy food. The only thing is, that's already enough for Yosef to claim that they're acting suspiciously. Because since the words may Ayin Basem don't necessarily mean what are you doing here, they could mean simply where are you from. If he claims he only asked them where they're from, but they gave additional information which is so redundant because everyone who's in Egypt at that point has come to buy food. So it almost sounds like they're emphasizing that they're there to buy food because they're covering up the real reason that they're there. They're volunteering too much information in his claim, even though in their estimation it was exactly what they were asked. That was the hook. And therefore, Yosef says, may Ayin Basem, which is a vav almost. It doesn't come back the way that it came. And the brother said, we're from Canaan, we come to buy food. And Yosef said, why are you saying you came to buy food? Why else are you here? And one thing, things quickly downward spiraled. And once a person's accused of being a spy, it's very difficult to get out of it. Because the more he demonstrates how innocent he is, the better a spy he is. So it's the sort of thing, once it starts, difficult to know where it will stop. And therefore, what Yehuda is saying is, you never asked us if we had a brother, but you asked us a question in a way that we had no choice but to say it, and that's really what you wanted to hear. And if we look back again in Pasuk Yotes, Adoni sha'al es avadav lemor. The word lemor is interesting because you can legitimately not translate it, or you can translate it as saying, which is the equivalent of not translating it, because if you say anything, you're saying. But the word lemor, for some mepharshim, is an infinitive. Lemor means to say. And when you ask a question lemor, that means you ask a question with the goal of someone saying something. That's what Yehuda is saying. You never asked us if we had a brother, but you asked us a question lemor, so that we would say, Hayesh lechem avo ach. And therefore, what Yehuda is respectfully putting to this leader is that it was never about us, it was always about him, and it doesn't, and you really would need to explain that. Especially as, moving on, when we come to Pasuk Kaf Gimel, so Yosef says, Vatomer l'avadecha, im lo yered achichem akaton etchem, if the younger brother doesn't come down with you, lo sisifun lo erspana, you can't see me again. Now, here too, Yehuda, as the Alshech explains, is putting something to Yosef here. As if to say, what's the claim? Officially the claim is that you're spies. And in order to prove the veracity of their story, somehow if they only have a brother, then everything will be okay. But they could still be spies, even if they have a brother. Spies also have brothers. And moreover, says Yehuda, what did you do? You held one of us hostage. You sent 10 of us back. Or 9 of us back. Except the point is, if you really thought that we were spies, why on earth would you send 9 of us back home? As if to say, you accuse us, right, you've come to spy out the land, and do what with it? And go home and tell whoever you wish to tell about it. And if that was a real suspicion, there's no way in the world any of us would ever have left. How many of 10 spies does it take to relay a message? 1, and certainly 9 can do the job. So what was served in terms of protecting, if it was a real suspicion, how were you in any way safeguarding the interests of Egypt by letting 9 of us go home? We could tell them everything. And then come back with a brother. And it's for this reason, amongst other things, that Yehuda really, the way that he's telling the story, it's more than retelling the story. It's more than establishing their innocence. It's also intimating Yosef's guilt, really. He has to answer for this, because it doesn't check out in a linear sense. That's the comments of the Alshich there. And moreover, just a final point that he makes in Pasuk Lamed Beis. It's a long speech. Ki abdecha aravet hanar me'im avi lemor. For I have taken responsibility for the nar, for Binyamin, to say, im lo avi ene elecha v'chatasi l'avi kol hayamim. If I don't bring it back, I'll be in a state of sin. He put a cherim on himself. And although on a simple level, we understand that what Yehuda means to say is, the reason why I of all the brothers am coming forward here is because I have the most to lose. Because I was the one that pledged that I'd be in Cherem and in a state of Chet if I didn't bring Binyamin back. But the point is, it's more than that, as a number of Meforshim point out, the Alshich and others, because Yehuda isn't just saying this to get himself out of trouble. But the reality is, what he's about to do will not get him out of trouble. For he is suggesting himself as a replacement for Binyamin. His pledge to Yaakov was very specifically, im lo avienu elecha, if I do not bring him back to you, and v'chatasi la'avi. And therefore, in order to get out of the situation that he put himself into, he will need to bring Binyamin back. The situation as it stands is that he sent back without Binyamin. What he is suggesting is that Binyamin should go back and not him. Both ways leave him without having fulfilled his pledge. And therefore what Yehuda is saying is, don't think, on the contrary, don't think that the only reason I'm saying this is for self-interest, to absolve myself of my responsibilities, because I won't do that. On the contrary, I'm going to stay here, I'm not going to bring him back, so I'm still going to be in Cherem, but it's worth it for me, because as far as our father is concerned, he would prefer to see Binyamin. He can't bear that Binyamin wouldn't be there. He'll be able to bear it if I'm not there. So that's a very interesting further point there. So these are some observations of the Alshich, and again, kedarko, to be medaktik in the nuances and the finer points of the psukim, what the word leimor might mean, and it gives a new understanding as to the content and goal of Yehuda's words here. But it is interesting to point out that beyond the details, there is a much more general shift, shall we say, in how the brothers are relating to Yosef. If we compare how they spoke to him at the end of last week's parsha, when the gavia was found by Binyamin, in Binyamin's sack, so the brothers, they were prepared for the worst, and they accepted it, and they submitted to it, and they said, okay, he'll be killed, there's nothing we can do about that, we're all your avodim, and they really accepted everything. And when Yosef says, no, Binyamin will stay with me and you'll be home, which only gave them clemency, all of a sudden the tone changes and they're no longer as accepting really of anything. And the question is, what brought about really this shift in attitude? This isn't really just another iteration of the way they've been acting so far. It's actually a change in direction fundamentally. And a very interesting, I believe a fascinating insight here. It's said in the name of the Gera Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael. I'm not sure where else it's recorded. I saw it as being recorded in the writings of Rav Shilo Rafael. That's our Shilo Rafael, who was the head of Machon Yerushalayim, and he was very close to many of the Gedolim. And this he quotes from the Beis Yisrael. To understand a bit of the mindset of the brothers as they meet this very inscrutable leader and inexplicable circumstances as well. And they seem to go along with it. And what's behind that? One could say they had no choice. But we should remember that there is a subtext which accompanies the then-Jewish people really from the times of Avram. And that is, it's known to them that at a certain point they will be forced to live in, to sojourn in another country, and they will become avodim. The Brit Ben Abesorim, which was said to Avram, is then transmitted to Yitzchak, and from Yitzchak to Yaakov, and from Yaakov to his sons. Now, so far, that hasn't really happened, but they know that it's on the cards, and once you know that, and that's almost in their consciousness, that it changes the way that you would perceive certain events. Specifically, when they come to Mitzrayim, and there's no natural way to explain why it is that they seem to be being pulled into Mitzrayim. First, most of them, and then all of them. And what are they to make of all of this? Do they have any way to explain it? They do, because in the back of their mind, and maybe even close to the front of their mind, they see that they are now Be'eretz Lelahem, they're Geirim Be'eretz Lelahem, and they're in trouble somehow. They've been framed, but the upshot is they end up potentially now being in the service of this leader. What does that mean for them? How do they relate to that? For them, that is the fulfillment of Ger Yezarecha Vavodim Ve'inu Osam, and that's why they submit to it, because they know that it will happen. They know that it's waiting to happen. This is apparently it, and that's why we don't find resistance. They'll protest their innocence, but there isn't such any type of aggressive move against it. All of that's true until the final pasuk of last week's parsha, when the whole thing crumbles. Because Yosef at that stage says to them, it's okay. You don't all have to be my servants. He will be, and you can go home. And at this point, everything really crashes, because that doesn't now make any sense on any level. How can it be that only one of them will be? That's not Bris Ben Abesarim. Ger Yezarecha is all of them. That almost all of them are sent home, and this isn't Ger Yezarecha. At this point, there's a paradigm shift. And from a certain point of view, for the first time, they actually look at the situation as something that they need to be more proactive in, because if it's not Bris Ben Abesarim, so they've got to deal with it. And that's the background to Yehuda coming forward to do whatever he can, the very least to secure the release of Binyamin, because Bris Ben Abesarim, it certainly isn't. So says the Gera Rebbe. Very interesting. What's, of course, fascinating is a bit of an irony here, and that is that it really was the beginning of the Bris Ben Abesarim. It's just not in the way that they expected it, and therefore within their frame they felt they had to take action, but the reality was what they thought it was, it really was. It just took a little bit longer for all the pieces to come together. So that's a very interesting insight as well, to try and perhaps be conscious perhaps of some of the elements that were factoring in as in terms of what they made of this situation. Now, as Yaakov, of course, Yosef, he finally reveals his identity to the brothers. They go up to tell Yaakov, and Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim. And if we move on to Perek Mem Vav Pasuk Aleph, so we will see there's quite a bit to say from a number of points of view on this first pasuk. Perek Mem Vav Pasuk Aleph. Vayisa Yisrael v'chol asher lo. So Yaakov travels, and he's called Yisrael, as the Malbim points out. Whenever Yaakov does something which really has ramifications for all of the future of the Jewish people, he's referred to in the pasuk as Yisrael, and this is really the Jewish people leaving, you know, Eretz Canaan and going down to Mitzrayim. Vayavo be'er hashava, he comes to Be'er Sheva. Vayizbach zvachim lelokei Aviv Yitzchak. and offers korbanos to the God of his father Yitzhak. Rashi notes, of course, that only Yitzhak is mentioned, and therefore Rashi says, famous comment, Chayav Adam, why only Yitzhak? Chayav Adam b'chavod aviv, yose mikavod zikno. A person is obligated to honor his father more than his grandfather. Lefichach tala b'yitzhak b'lo b'avraham. That's why the korbanos, when it mentions to the God of his father, Yitzchak, and not Avram, because between the two of them, he has more of an obligation of kavod than he does to Yitzchak than he does to Avram, to his father than to his grandfather. Interestingly, and we'll come back to Rashi, but there is quite a different explanation which is given by a number of Mefarshim to explain why it is that Yitzchak specifically is mentioned here. And really, the question is, what's the goal of the korbanos? I mean, he's on the way. Most people, when they're traveling from A to B, they don't offer korbanos. Yaakov, when he was leaving Vayetze, when he was leaving to Haran, it's not something that's typically done to offer a korban before one moves from one country to another. So what's the goal of this korban? That's really the question. Well, for Rashi, as we'll see, it's something of a korban hodah. You know, Yosef is alive, etc. But other Mepharshim say somewhat differently. The Masi Hashem, Rabbi Elezer Ashkenazi, says that actually when Yaakov is offering a korban here, it's because he wishes to commune, so to speak, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He wishes to have a certain closeness because he's actually unsure as to what he should do. After all, this is the first time that we have someone in Eretz Yisrael, leaving Eretz Yisrael, who's not in danger. As if to say, Avram has left Eretz Canaan because there was a famine in the land. Yaakov has already left Eretz Canaan once because Esav was trying to kill him. So no one has really ever left for anything less than Pikuach Nefesh. And here really is Yaakov saying, well, Yosef is in Mitzrayim, I should go and see him. Of course he wants to go and see him, but the question is he entitled to go and see him? After all, he's leaving Eretz Canaan. It's not Yitzhak never left Canaan. And really, says the Masi Hashem, that's what Yaakov was wondering. And therefore he offers a korban, and it's called Lelokei Aviv Yitzhak, because it's really apropos of Hashem's relationship with Yitzhak that Yaakov is bringing this korban, as if to say, am I like Yitzhak now? Barring life-threatening circumstances, should I not leave? Even Yitzchak wasn't allowed to leave even when there was a famine. He was about to leave. Hashem appeared to him and said no. And therefore Hashem hasn't appeared to Yaakov, but Yaakov wants to hear from him as to whether it's acceptable for him to leave. And that's why Yitzchak's name is mentioned specifically, because that's what the korban is about. Am I in Yitzchak mode? Because if I am, I can't leave. Indeed, just pursuant to that, So Hashem appears to him actually in Pasuk Gimel and says, "Vayomer Anochi Hakel Elokei Avicha." Yes, I'm the God of your father, but in your case, Al Tira Merda Mitzrayim. So you do need to go down, and that was the sanction that Yaakov was waiting for. But to come back to Rashi, and once again we remind ourselves, Rashi explains that how do we respond, or what do we make of the fact that it says Elokei Aviv Yitzchak specifically, that he has more of an obligation to honor Yitzchak than he does to honor Avram. However, there is yet more to ponder here, because as true as it may be that between the two of them he has more of an obligation to give kavod to Yitzchak than to Avram, but why does it come out here? And the background to that question is, this is not the first time that Yaakov is mentioned in relationship to, or in relation to his father and his grandfather. We have tefillos of Yaakov, both before this point and after this point. And in those tefillos he mentions both Avram and Yitzchak. So if we're looking, shall we say, for consistency, if we're looking for a constant theme, so why is it that in some places, for example, in the beginning of Vayishlach, when he davens that Hashem should save him from Esav, he says, Vayomer Hashem, Elokei Avi Avraham, Elokei Avi Yitzchak. So Avram and Yitzchak, and that's okay, and that's not considered a violation of his covenant to Yitzchak to mention Avram. He mentions Avram first, I guess the chronological order, and that's okay. In next week's Parsha, Parsha's Vayechi, when he says again, Elokei Avi Avram, Elokei Avi Avi Yitzchak, right? Hakel or whatever we see before Hamalach Hagoa, the shame of Esai, Avram and Yitzchak, and that's, it's acceptable. First Avram, then Yitzchak, and nothing is out of place. Yet here, when he offers a korban, it's specifically Elokei Yitzchak, and it becomes an issue. And there's a message here. But why does it come on this middle case? That's the question that the Ramban asks. The Taz, Rabbi David Alevi, in his Pirish Divrei David, the Taz explains that this korban, this setting is different. It's a fine point here. The other cases that we mentioned of where he speaks about Avram and Yitzhak are tefillos. Save me from Esav. Malach Agor lo si Yashereid. Hashem should bless the Yivarech Hasan Arim. Here, it's a korban hodah, as if to say, and that's how the Taz understands what Rashi means to say. Why is he bringing a korban? The zevach todah, zvachim, lecha is that zevach todah, Yosef is alive, that's his way of saying thanks. What's the difference between a tefillah and a todah? The difference is, says the Taz, in a tefillah, you need all the help you can get, because you don't know, and you can't just choose, as if to say, if you have two illustrious forebears, Avram and Yitzchak, mention both of them, and that's not a slight on anyone's honor, because what you're saying is, this is not about who I have to give cover to, this is about however many zechuyos I can, I can't afford to be picky at a time like this, I'm in danger. And therefore, whenever you're davening for the future, it's in place to mention both of them, and no one, you don't have to choose. However, there's a slightly different dynamic when a person is giving hodah. Because when you're giving hodah, what you're saying is, in the merit of, obviously not in your own merit, but in the merit of others, you were able to have this good news or this good thing happen to you. And there, on the contrary, the more people you mention, perhaps looking back, it's not considered such a kavod. Because really the implication is, I needed the collective merit of all of these people in order for that good result to come. So on the contrary, there it's more covered just to mention one of them, as if to say, this person alone, his merit sustained me. And that's the time when you have to choose. And if you have to choose, who you're going to choose? The one that you're mechuyev to be mechabit more, and that is the father over the grandfather. Yitzchak here mentioned, and not Avram. So that's quite a subtle distinction. When one, when two, looking backwards, looking forwards, that's the Rashi. Now it's interesting to see, after all, one cannot look at a Rashi like this, especially Rashi begins with the word chayav, and chayav means obligated, and obligated sounds like halachically obligated, and not wonder, no, so is a person chayav to honor his grandfather? Well, did this make it into the Shulchan Aruch? So interestingly, the Ramah is the one who discusses this matter in Hilchus, well, Kibbutz Eim, in Yeridah. Simen Reish Mem, Si'if Kaf Dalet. And, you may not be surprised to hear, the Ramah records two views on the matter. Yesh Omrim. The first is from the Maharik, Rabbi Yosef of Kolon, the Maharik Kolon. And it's a great late Rishonim. Yesh omrim, de'ein adam chayav b'chvod avi aviv. Some say a person is not obligated specifically in the honor of his grandfather. Okay, that doesn't mean he's chayav to dishonor him, but in terms of an obligation, that's the Maharik. But the Ramah himself comments and says, ve'ein nearly. That doesn't appear to be correct. I think he does. Ella the chay bechvod aviv yosem bechvod avi aviv. Okay, he's obligated to honor his father more than his grandfather, but the grandfather is still a chiyuv. And there's brackets, and I think the brackets are from the Ramah. V'raya, and the proof is mi medrash gabei vayitzbach zevachim etc., which is a reference to our pasuk. I mean, you see from here that there's an obligation to honor the grandfather as well, just not as much as the father, but it's still by implication. So it's an interesting situation, because on the one hand, the Maharik, seemingly oblivious to this or not somehow taking into account the Medrash quoted by Rashi, that there is some level of obligation. And he just says, no, there's no obligation. And the Ramah is bearing the flag for the Rashi. But how could the Maharik respond to the Medrash? I mean, the Medrash is from Chazal. Maharik is one of the later Rishonim. He can't overlook something like that. Well, the truth of the matter is, it's a little bit more involved. And the reason why is because as soon as you quote a Medrash in the realms of Halacha, that immediately raises a question. And that is, does the Halacha base itself on things that are mentioned in Midrashim? Even halachic statements that are mentioned in Midrashim. There is a principle, it's a Tosefta in Peah, Ein Lemeidim, we don't learn from our goddess, and seemingly that is extended to whatever you'll find in the Medrash. So actually the question is, now shift to the Ramah, because why is the Ramah getting almost upset at the Maharik? What do you mean? You can prove it, it's from the Medrash. You can prove a lot of things from the Medrash, but not necessarily halacha. And this is a halachic discussion, so it's min b'she'eino mino. They're two separate discussions. So what is the measure of the Ramah's objection? However, the position that is adopted by many is that if you find the halachic position in a Medrash, and it's a major discussion amongst the even Rishonim and certainly Achronim, when you find a halachic discussion in the Medrash, is that halachically binding? The answer is, it depends. The preeminent halachic body of work is the Talmud, no question about that. And therefore, it's taken on a conditional basis, as if to say, if the Gemara doesn't talk about this in one way or the other, so that's neutral. And then you have a Medrash, so in neutral ground, the Medrash can give you a halacha. Should it be that the Gemara speaks about this and seems to give you a contrary message, so then the Gemara takes precedence over the Medrash. That seems to be the rule of thumb. And therefore, what the Ramah is saying is, to his knowledge, there's no Gemara which says that he has no obligation to honor a grandfather, which means in the absence of any statement to the contrary from the Talmud, so you should learn from the Medrash. And that's his objection to the Maharik. Whatever happened to the Medrash, how can you say there's no obligation? But what's interesting is, it's possible that the Maharik Kolon, who said that there's no obligation, which means he's not adopting the position of the Medrash, is because he feels that he did find somewhere in the Talmud which indicates that there is no obligation to honor a grandfather. What is that instance? Well, it's in a rather difficult situation, which is discussed in Maseches Makos, which already sounds somewhat foreboding. Daf Yud Beis Amud Beis, oh sorry, Yud Beis Amud Aleph, which deals with the halacha of Rotzeach Bishgaga, someone who kills accidentally. And the halacha, as we know, is that if someone who kills accidentally, not only does he need to go to an Ir Miklat, but also for other family members can become what's called the Goel Hadam. They become the avenger, and they can kill him. So now the Gemara, because the Gemara has to discuss all cases, otherwise you're not prepared for all cases, so the Gemara discusses the question, what if someone, lo aleinu, accidentally kills his son? So now which of the family members can become the Goel Hadam? And the Gemara states, another one of the brothers could never be the Goel Hadam. One of the brothers can't become, avenge the brother and kill the father. But one of the deceased sons could be a Goel Hadam to kill the grandfather. And Rashi explains, one of the brothers can't be because of Kibbutz Av. But one of the grandsons could be because there's no such obligation. And therefore, from this rather difficult case in the Makkos there, we do see the Gemara seems to indicate, like the Maharik Kolon is saying, that there's no obligation to honor a grandfather. So now the question will shift back to the Ramah. Well, then why are you so insistent that we adopt the position of the Medrash if it's in conflict with the Gemara? So that we have to see. But what's interesting is, to raise the question before we get into the Gemara versus the Medrash, so to speak, but to raise the question, why is it? Why is a person obligated to honor his grandfather? As if to say, parents is in the Torah, kabedes avicha v'simecha. I mean, how are we to understand the idea that there would be an obligation for grandparents as well? And here we actually find three distinct interpretations amongst the Mefarshim. Each one in their own angle, their own approach. The Sefer Haredim, Rabbi Elazar Iskari from Tzfat, explains that the principle of honoring a grandfather is based on another principle which we know, which is B'nei Banim, Harehim Kibanim, that the sons of sons are like sons, and that's the concept that Rashi quotes. And if it's true that the sons of sons are like sons, grandchildren are like children, so a corollary of that is the extension of this idea that as surely as children have to honor their parents, they also have to honor their grandparents because their grandparents are like their parents. If Bnei Bonim are Kebonim, then Avi Avos are Ka'avos, and it's somehow subsumed to some degree within Kabeda Savicha Ve'esimecha. And this is indeed something that we find even in the Torah itself, where Hashem, for example, appears to Yaakov again in the beginning of Vayetze and says, "Vayomer ani Hashem Elokei Avraham Avicha." He calls Avram Yaakov. He calls Avram Yaakov's father. It's his grandfather, but it's called Avicha, and that's really from the pasuk itself. And there are even halachic implications for this idea of Bnei Bonim Kebonim. Sometimes, for various reasons, even giving an aliyah to the Torah, I believe it's a pasuk of the Marshal. Sometimes the name of the father isn't known. The name of the grandfather would be known. Perhaps the father didn't have a Jewish name or whatever it may be. And the Marshal says if for some reason it becomes impossible or not an option to call him to the Torah with Ben, his father, so then you can 100% call him by his grandfather because Bnei Banim Harehim Kibanim, that's his father in this respect. So that's the Sefer Haredim. Why is it that one has an obligation to honor a grandfather? Because Bnei Banim Harehim Kibanim. The Bach explains that the idea behind this is more, in a sense, the idea behind Kibud Avein, as if to say, why is a person obligated to honor his parents? Because they brought him into the world; they're partners in his creation, as the Gemara says, "Shlosha Shutvim BaAdam," the father, the mother, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's that. Well, says the Bach, if that's true, then in a sense there are other partners, because if you look at, you know, who is responsible for you coming into the world, well, it's your father and your mother. But how did they get into the world? For their father and their mother, and they're also partners, and therefore the svara, in a sense, behind kibud av does extend ultimately. Of course, they're lesser partners in a sense. They're actually senior partners, but they're minority shareholders. So, but nonetheless, they do, you know, they did make their contribution, and therefore, to some degree, in a sense, therefore, it splits up. The primary partners, as far as this person is concerned, are his parents, but then secondary partners are the grandparents, and that's how the Bach explains. Quite a different explanation is to be found in the Sechem, the third of our three explanations. Again, our question is, if we're only aware explicitly of the idea of Kabedas Avicha V'Timecha, where does the mitzvah of honoring grandparents come from? And the Stechemed explains that perhaps there is no actual mitzvah to honor a grandfather, but there's a mitzvah to honor your father. And it gives cover to your father if you honor your grandfather, because that's his father. It's quite different. It's not so much a linear obligation. It's really more focusing on his own kibud av. But part of kibud av is to honor his parents. I mean, that's where he came from, and that's covered to him as well. So that's the interpretation of the Stechemet. So we see three quite different approaches. And perhaps, certainly, we can see quite clearly that, according to this approach, going back to the Gemara in Makos, which seem to indicate that there is no obligation to honor a grandfather. And again, to remind ourselves, the case was, this tragic case, the person accidentally killed his son. Who can become the Goel Adam? Not one of the brothers. They can't kill their father. keep it up, so they can't become the girl Adam. But one of the deceased sons, right, the grandson, he can kill him. Why? Because, says Rashi, there's no obligation to honor a grandfather. No obligation? That seems not like the Medrash. But the Rama endorses the Medrash. Yes, according to the Stechemed, there is an obligation to honor the grandfather, but only as an expression, really, of honoring the father himself. And here it is honoring his father by being the Goel Adam for his death. And therefore, on the contrary, here the two clash, because the grandson, it's in the interest of Kibud Av that he actually becomes the Goel Adam. At that point, it's not considered contravening the obligation of the Kibud Avi Avi. And that's just the final point, which has bothered many, in fact. There is a principle that if a person has a conflict sometimes between who to honor, between A and B, it makes a big difference if B also has to honor A. Because in a sense, that's the umbrella, and they all need to therefore defer to that. The classic example, of course, Hashem says, if your father tells you to break Shabbos, you don't have to listen to him. Whatever happened to Kibud Av Ha'Em, Kulchem Chayovim Bechavodi, right? You have an obligation to honor me, says Hashem, and so does he. So your obligation to honor him is secondary to that, because he himself has an obligation to honor me, and so do you. And therefore, whenever they have someone to honor in common, that one takes precedence. And therefore, Mefarshim asked, why is it that the honor of one's father takes precedence over the honor of the grandfather? Isn't it true that you and the father both have an obligation to honor the grandfather? So you should say, Kulchem chayavim bichvodo, and his honor should take precedence. Why is it secondary? But according to the Sfasemes, pardon me, according to the Stechemed, we understand that there is no actual, so to speak, obligation for the grandson to honor the grandfather. It's only really an expression of kavod aviv, and therefore kavod aviv will take precedence. So these are some of the, in a sense, the highlights of what's a very interesting situation, because it begins in the Pasuk. It begins with, and it's embracious, which is, we're not formally meant to be learning halakhas yet, but of course we do, to some degree. And to see how it begins with the Pasuk and resolves issues in the Pasuk, and then moves and of course opens up that whole question of learning halakha from the Medrash, with conflict from the Gemara, without conflict from the Gemara. There's plenty to discuss there, and of course much material for drushas given by either grandparents or grandchildren, depending on which sources they identify with or understand better. So, if we just move one pasuk further in pasuk Dalet to see Hashem's message, we're really in pasuk Gimel, Hashem's message to Yaakov. Yaakov, according to the Ma'ati Hashem, was asking for a message, and he got one. The answer is, you're going down to Mitzrayim, but he receives a reassurance. Vayomer, Hashem says, Anochi Akel Elokei Avicha, again, I am the God of your father Yitzhak, but he didn't go down, but you're going down. Al Tirame Dor Mitzrayim, don't be afraid. But of course, don't be afraid means Yaakov is afraid. That's why he needs to be reassured. Ki Lugoi Gadol Asim Hashem, there you will be made into a great nation. Inexplicable, but so it is. Anochi Eredimcha Mitzrayim, I'll go down with you to Mitzrayim. Vanochi Alcha Gamalo, and I'll come up with you from Mitzrayim, which is another way of saying you can't come up before I tell you to come up. And now these final words, V'yosef Yoshis Yado Alinecha, and Yosef will place his hands on your eyes. What is the meaning of that final expression? It's somewhat more enigmatic than the others. Yosef Yoshis Yado Al Einecha. I believe the common understanding, which is actually the Perush of the Ibn Ezra, if I'm not mistaken, is that it's a reference to Yosef putting his hands on Yaakov's eyes when he'll pass away. And although that's for Yaakov, that is some measure of reassurance, because Yaakov was all these years thought that Yosef had predeceased him. And within context, that's the reassurance that that will not be the case, and Yosef will be the one to close Yaakov's eyes. Yashis yado al einecha. It's very interesting, remains interesting, that of all the things that Yaakov is worried about, this becomes this is something he needs to be reassured about. But so it is. There are some meforshim, those who are known as the Baalei HaPshat, the Rashbam, and the Radak, and others, who have a different understanding, that the word einecha here, they translate not as your eyes, but rather as your affairs. Now, how does einecha come to mean your affairs? Because the word einecha is really a contracted form of inyanecha, of the things that you're involved with, the affairs that you're involved with. And how do we ever see this? That the word einecha, the word ayin, is like inyan. That's really what they're saying. Ayin is like inyan. Einecha is inyanecha. Well, in the Lashon of the Chachamim, you find it a lot. Because whenever you find the expression of me'ein something, and we find it a lot, we talk about me'ein olam haba, you talk about me'ein shalosh, right, or me'ein sheva, or whatever it may be. And what does me'ein mean? It captures the essence of it. It's me'ein is really me'inyan. It partakes of that matter. It's very interesting. Otherwise, what does the word me'ein mean? Me'ein olam haba means me'inyan olam haba. Me'ein sheva, me'inyan sheva. And therefore, they say that what Hashem is telling Yaakov, Yosef will take care of you. Yashis yado, alinecha means alinyanecha. Very interesting. But that's far from Rishonim. But there is a very special comment of the Meshech Chochma on these words, v'yosef yashis yado alinecha. And I saw that this week that there is corroboration for this idea from an earlier source as well. And it's just a few lines, and it's important to hear. I think you can't substitute for his own words. Again, commenting on this phrase, v'yosef yashis yado alinecha. Yitachen, it may be possible to suggest, ki amarlo, that what Hashem is telling Yaakov, shebal yachkor bi'iuno, that he should not try and investigate with his faculties, uve'ein of hasichliyim, and with his insight, al tachlis amahus ha'inyan, shetzarech lerid mitzrayim v'la'alos, to begin to ponder what will be achieved, what's the purpose here of going down to Mitzrayim and of coming up, to try and fathom it and understand it. How could this possibly bring shleimus? If we're in Yaakov's position, Mitzrayim is the lowest of the low, Eretz Canaan is the place where he should be, and he's being told to go down. What good could come of it? And that's what he's thinking. On the contrary, the only directives that people have ever received from HaKadosh Baruch Hu about location is always to go to Eretz Canaan. Hashem told Avram to go to Canaan, to stay there. Now, it's true that Avram went to Mitzrayim. He made that decision because he felt it was necessary. Hashem would never tell him to go to Mitzrayim. And Yitzhak was said, Dafka stopped from leaving at all, under any circumstances. Ma'at ha'taklis, what's the purpose? So what's the answer to that? Amar, ki ha'inyin shal Yosef yashis yado aleinecha. Yosef will cover your eyes. Let him place his hand on your eyes. And what does that mean? It means shezeh inyan yatzomei necha. You should close your eyes when you think of Yosef, as if to say you should desist from trying to work it out. And if you feel that you need to work it out and you can't work it out, just remember Yosef, and that will reassure you. Because Yosef had the same thing. Shebal tachkor bal tistakel achidaki ashkocha ki ramu. The ways of divine providence are much more elevated than you can fathom. What did everyone think would happen to Yosef? They thought it was that nothing good would come of it. That either he's dead or if he's alive, there's no good outcome. And look at him now. Ki mimi leil ze asher atzar shel Yosef yehi letachlis nir tzakase. Who would have imagined that all of that difficulties with Yosef would lead to the outcome that it did? Sheyador b'Mitzrayim v'yele shalit. He's the leader. He's in charge, b'yafarsim deos tzodkos, and he's actually spreading at least some type of positive message there, being in that position of leadership. The chalaaretz yukafufim lo, the entire nation is under his auspices. Halo zeh ha'inyan, remember Yosef, when your eyes are troubling you in this matter, as if to say, you think, how could it be? Remember Yosef, because no one could understand that. But you've seen the end of that. You haven't seen the end of this yet, but let the first give you reassurance. And that's what it means to cover your eyes. Says Meshech Chochma, that's within a certain, not so much a textual explanation, but he did feel that that's part of what Hashem is saying to Yaakov. Yosef, let Yosef cover your eyes. Yosef all worked out. No one could have fathomed how. Just like you can't fathom how this will work out. Don't think about it. You won't be able to work it out. But know that it will, Yosef. And thus far, the Meshech Chochma, a really very beautiful section. And what's interesting is, there is a statement of the Zohar HaKadosh on this pasuk, which really would seem to corroborate what the Meshech Chochma is saying. And that is, on this pasuk again, Yosef Yoshish Yado Aleinecha, he places his hand on your eyes, says the Zohar HaKadosh, V'do hi rosa dekriyat Shema. That's the secret of Shema. Now, what does that mean, that's the secret of Shema? The Zohar seems to be referring to the fact that when we say Shema, we put our hands over our eyes. Everyone does that every day. And that's a question as to where that comes from, and what is it doing, what's it serving. But really, the pasuk of Shema discusses a similar theme. Because Shema Yisrael, which is really a declaration, and when you declare something to someone, which that means that they need to hear it from you, or you need to hear it from yourself. Hashem Elokeinu, which is two really conflicting paths, as we know. Hashem is Rachamim, and Elokim is Din, and they both exist, and we don't really know why one is there at this place and the other. And then the pasuk concludes, Hashem Echad, Hashem is one, meaning all of them ultimately will be unified. They're not at the moment. It's impossible to work it out. From a certain point of view, anyone who lives in the world, when the world is in a state of galus, is in Yaakov's position. He looks at the world, tries to understand as best he can, but he gets stymied the whole time. He gets flummoxed because that seems to work out, that doesn't seem to work out, and somehow he's meant to understand that all of this in the end will work out. How can he do that? He can't understand it. And to that end, says the Zohar, he puts his hands on his eyes, because really what he's saying is, something I understand, something's not, the rest I take on trust. Right, Yashish Yado Aleinecha, and the Zohar mentioning this in this pasuk really seems to, it said, bear out what the Meshech Chochma is saying very beautifully. That's the idea of Yosef putting his hands on Yaakov's eyes. So just a final comment with regards to Yosef in Mitzrayim, because that's really how the parsha concludes. What is Yosef doing in Mitzrayim? What's he doing for the Jewish people? Well, he's feeding the world, he's feeding his family. But we know there is a principle of Ma'aseh Ovosim Labanim, that the experiences of the later generations of the sons have been pre-experienced by the Avos. And as the Mefarshim explain, they're pre-experienced in micro, on a personal level, in order to facilitate the experience as it will happen in macro, on a national level. And the Maharal sees within Yosef's stay an element of an aspect of Ma'aseh Avos Siman Labanim, because Yosef, in a sense, pre-experienced the difficulties of Mitzrayim and the triumphs of Mitzrayim before the rest of the Jewish people did. Now, we may ask, is Yosef one of the Avos? Is Yosef an Av that we can say Ma'aseh Avos Siman Labanim? He's one of the Banim. He's one of the tribes. Well, it happens to be that with regards to Yosef, it's a bit more complex. And the reason why is that Yosef is something of a transitional figure between the Avos and the Banim. We find, for example, that the Avos, what characterizes them, is that their lives are encapsulated in Sefer Bereishis. That means they're born and die in Sefer Bereishis. Everybody else, they may be born in Bereishis, but then their death will be recorded maybe later in Sefer Shemos. Sefer Bereishis is the Sefer HaYetzirah, as the Ramban describes it. It's the primary creative forces. So the Avos, their lives are encapsulated in Bereishis. The Shvatim, we hear only of their passing in Shemos, which is already... And what about Yosef? Yosef's passing is mentioned in both Chumashim. It's mentioned at the end of Bereishis, and again the beginning of Shemos, by Yomas Yosef v'cholachav v'choladar ha'hu. And that really gives us to understand that Yosef is both an Av and a Ben. We find as well in certain respects that Yosef himself has Shvatim. His children are Shvatim, Ephraim and Manasseh, with certain respects. And therefore, as surely as Yaakov had 12 tribes, and then the tribes had children, but Yosef himself has two tribes. And therefore, Yosef is an interesting, he's al hagvul, as they say, transitional figure. In fact, the Tur in Hilchos Rosh Chodesh tells us that the three regalim correspond to the avos. Pesach corresponds to Avram, Shavuos to Yitzhak, Sukkos to Yaakov. There's only Shlolish regalim, except Sukkos itself concludes with Shmini Atzeres. And Shmini Atzeres, in some respects, is considered to be a new its own regal. You make Shechiyanu in Shmini Atzeres. It's not just the last day of Sukkos, but in some respects it is the last day of Sukkos. And Futner explains that Shmini Atzeres corresponds to Yosef, because like Yosef, it's yes and no. In some respects, number four, in other respects, an extension of number three. And therefore, says Maral, you see that Yosef, he began as an Eved, really, the Eved Nimkar Yosef, and then in the end he emerges triumphant. That pre-experiences that process for the Jewish people, Avodah Mayinu, Vayotzienu. And moreover, one of the trademarks of really the Jewish experience in Mitzrayim is that they were very careful and managed to protect themselves in matters of physical relationships, and they did not succumb. And that's also, that groundwork is prepared for them by Yosef, who had his nisayon with Eishes Potiphar, and he withstood, and that again bestows and instills the fortitude for his descendants to do that. And it's fascinating to consider in this regard a statement of the Yerushalmi in the end of Maseches Psachim, which talks about the Arba Kosos. Where do the Arba Kosos come from? What do they correspond to? Well, there are many answers, but the two primary answers, of course, number one, if there has to be one, it will be the four lishonos of Geula, Votesi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti. But the Yerushalmi, in the same chapter, says something less likely, and that is that the four cups on Seder night correspond to the four times that the word kos is mentioned in the butler's dream in the end of Parshas Vayeshev. Dustoff and Kenan, as they say. What's the butler got to do with Seder night? I mean, we're happy the butler got out. I mean, I guess perhaps we are, maybe we are, maybe we're not. But how does that affect us on Seder night? Except the Mefarshim explain, that's the roots of Seder night. The dream of the butler and his release, which led to, that's the turning point for Yosef. And on a root level, that is the beginning of the Geula, because as Yosef emerges to freedom on the Maisa Avos level, that gives the power for his descendants to on a Siman Abanim level. And thus you find the most unusual thing, that four cups of wine on Seder night were celebrating the release of the butler from prison, with all that represented. That's the Mefarshim saying. I just always add a certain hargosha here, and that is that Yosef's success was built on interpreting two dreams there, the butler and the baker. The butler had his wine, but what about the baker? But isn't it interesting to consider that we always have Lechem Mishnah on Yom Tov? There's only one Yom Tov where we don't have Lechem Mishnah, but rather we have three matzahs, one on top of the other. And perhaps that's a reverberation of the other dream, because the Sar HaOfim, he had three baskets on his head, baked goods, one on top of the other. And therefore, between the wine and the matzahs, you have Sar HaMashkim and Sar HaOfim, and that's the Maaseh Avos for what we celebrate on Seder Yetzias Mitzrayim. We'll leave it over there.